Welcome back. You're listening to Tide Smart Talk with Steve on News Talk WLOB, 1310 AM, 100.5 FM. Great theme music this week, Emily. Back to school.
Thank you.
Haven't listened to AC/DC in a while. But that's our introduction for our very special guest this week. Please join me in welcoming Javier Botana, who is the recently named, soon to launch. He's been working at it for a few months now, but with the new school year starting, the new superintendent of the Portland Public Schools. Welcome, Javier.
Thank you very much. It's great to be here.
It's great to have you here. So, so much to cover. We talk about education frequently on this show. We've had leadership from both in terms of your predecessor in the Portland Public School System, which is the biggest school system, I think, here in Maine, but also all the university presidents. And I personally feel that education is the bedrock, the foundation of it impacts every area of an organized society, whether it has to do with the economy or kind of social connections. So it's so important. But before we get into your new role and taking the new role of superintendent, let's spend a couple minutes just talking about your background, where you grew up, where you went to school, and then what led you to education. And then we'll talk about what's in store for the Portland Public Schools under your leadership.
Sure. I am originally, I was born in Cuba, and my family left when I was very young with the advent of the Cuban Revolution with Fidel Castro. My family, you know, lost everything, as so many people did, and decided to leave. So my grandparents lived in Spain, and so my parents handed us over to a stewardess, and we flew from Havana to Madrid. And
how old were you when
I was a little bit over 2 years old at the time, and my younger brother was like 45 days old at the time. And so
handed you over to a stewardess, and sure, that yeah. was the way I'm guessing the family perspective was, wanting a better life or wanting more, absolutely, better education, health care. Yeah. That in itself could be a two-hour show,
yeah,
just in
yeah.
terms of your experience and your family's experience in Cuba. Can you speak a little bit, because the last couple of years, particularly in the last year, before we move on talking about education, but I think Cuba is in the news, and I think there's some really interesting things. And over the last, you know, when I was a kid growing up with the Cuban Missile Crisis and then the embargo, Cuba was always associated with communist regime Russia. That was one of the allies. Yeah, that was kind of the element of the Cuban Missile Crisis. It has to be unbelievable for you and your family to see what's happened in the last year relative to, I don't want to say normalized relations, but certainly I think President Obama has done something that wasn't expected and fairly unique. I think right now travel linkage has been created. There are people, there's pop culture, there's plans for more tourism. What's your feeling coming from Cuba and now being in America, seeing what's happened? And do you have any thoughts in terms of how that relates to both people in Cuba? And there was some pushback, mostly political pushback, which I try not to listen to, that maybe we shouldn't have approached it as quick as we did, particularly since Fidel Castro, although he's very old now, and his brother Raul is in some form or another the leader. I know that there's a different government, but Fidel is still sending out, not anti-American, but he sounds like the cranky old guy, so yeah. I don't think people put much currency into what he's saying, but I think of it as a good thing, and I think the closer we can open up borders and let communication and let our values kind of permeate other societies, it's better for all of us. But what's your thought on the Cuba situation?
I don't know that it's a good thing or that it's a bad thing. It definitely is a different approach. And, you know, when you think of 50 years of, you know, a policy that's yielded the results that the previous policy had yielded, which is no regime change and no opening, it's hard to support continuing to do something that hasn't worked for over 50 years. My older brother, who left when he was 5 years old, is in Cuba as we speak. And he's the first member of the family to have gone back since we left, you know, 50 years ago. And he's there with his church, with a part of their outreach efforts. And, you know, we had a long conversation before he went, because, again, he's the first one. And for my grandparents, who had left before we did, right after the revolution, and for that generation, any form of support for the regime, you know, by going back, by sending money, by doing anything along those lines, was a symbol of treason to, you know, the people that lost so much. So, you know, clearly while they were alive, nobody in my family would have ever gone back. And now, you know, my dad has passed away. And, you know, when he was young and the revolution happened, he was, like so many people in that generation, hopeful that that was a good thing, and then became disenchanted over the years, and eventually realized that he needed to get out and get his family out. But he was a little more able to see the gray in the situation. The older generation just could not see that at all. And so, you know, and clearly being the first one going back, my brother has obviously blazed the trail. And, you know, I grew up hearing about Cuba. I have no own recollections of it other than, you know, growing up and listening to tales around the dinner table.
Well, we have Javier Botana, who is the new superintendent of Portland Public Schools. I think most people have very little real in-depth understanding of Cuba. But, you know, its proximity to the U.S. is in itself kind of amazing. I don't know if it's 90 miles or 100.
I think it's like 70 miles.
70 miles.
Off of, Key West.
Yeah. To Key West. So it, and then the relationship of Guantanamo, which, and I don't understand which treaty created it, but at some point in American and Cuban history, the U.S. basically, through treaty, took a piece of Cuba, and that is, in essence, it's non-Cuban land. It's America has jurisdiction. There's legal issues and military issues and all that. But so much oppression and so much pain and suffering over 50 years and people trying to escape an oppressive regime. So I think it's fascinating. So maybe, you know, love to have maybe with your, when your brother comes back by phone. I'm guessing he doesn't live in Maine.
No, he lives in Wisconsin.
You know, it's fascinating. And I think that the internet and connectivity hopefully is helping all types of, I don't want to say democracy, but I hope value systems are more easily accessed when people can see beyond what could be propaganda, what's beyond kind of repressive, like, oh, America's bad, or whether it's in the Mideast or Europe or in Cuba, and basically see that, oh, this is what America's about. This is what, then hopefully from a grassroots level, that can help in relationships, that can help ease misunderstandings, hatred, pain, and all the other stuff that kind of goes along with it.
And I think that that's the hope with this policy. You know, I you know, started by saying I reserve judgment on whether it works or not. But, you know, clearly the world is very different today than it was 50 years ago. We've tried 50 years of, you know, isolation. And, you know, I think that this is an effort to say, like, this is who we are. And, you know, we're not that different from you. And hopefully that, in the long run, opens doors that just currently don't exist.
I agree. And my final point is, if we can figure out how they can keep so many cars from the 50s and 60s running.
I think it's the climate.
I know. It must be the climate. But it is. They're almost stuck in time. Yeah. And so when you see pop culture references on TV shows or travel shows or films, there is still this fleet of cars. Yeah. And their paint, you know, it's time, but they're, you know, Cuba's an island. There's salt water, so there's salt. And you got to think, somehow, if we can get their automotive insights, and, you know, most people can't keep their car on the road for 4 years.
Yeah, and you think of those cars, and, you know, where do they get the parts? I mean, the outside is amazing in and of itself, but the fact that they're running and that they're the
and they haven't had access to the inventory, or there's no Napa store, and if your brake hydraulic thing breaks in a 62 Chevy, somebody there in Cuba must be, you know.
They must do amazing things with rubber bands and paper clips.
And again, I know I don't want to digress. That is the small truth associated with the new policy of Cuba, but it's kind of a funny pop culture. So growing up in Cuba and as a young boy at two, where did you grow up and how that?
So we left and we wound up in Spain for about a year and a half when my parents were able to get their visa and come to the U.S. And then we reunited as a family here and lived in the Chicago area for a number of years. And then we moved to Lancaster County, Pennsylvania. And that's where I started school. My best friend in elementary school was an Amish kid by the name of Henry. So we lived there for a while and my parents got a divorce, and so we moved with my grandparents back to Spain. I went to high school there and then came back to the U.S. to the Chicago area after I came back and went to college in the Chicago area. And most of my professional career has been there.
And talk about your professional career in terms of administration, being superintendent. We'll talk about that in general because I think people are familiar with schools in terms of the hierarchy of teachers and then principals. Or in my case, I was always sent to the vice principal.
You were one of those kids.
Yes. I think I was referred to 40 years ago as spirited. And I don't, you know, there may be new vocabulary.
Spirited works.
So that's probably crossed your desk in your history where, you know, in different roles you've had where, well, we've got the spirited kid. So what led you into the path of education and then ultimately administration and oversight of school systems? Okay. And then we'll talk about last May when you were one of at least 41 candidates to take over the Portland school system. And we'll talk about that role.
Yeah. So it kind of in many ways goes back to that story that I told about my family. You know, the first real sort of adult-like conversation that I can recall was with my grandma when I was probably 7 or 8 years old. It was after lunch one day, and I don't remember how we got to the topic, but she made me understand how education is the only thing that nobody can ever take away from you. And, you know, she tied it into her experience and my family's experience in Cuba and the fact that my parents both had a education. And so we had been in the U.S. for a number of years and my parents had, you know, progressed in their careers fairly quickly. My dad went back to school, got a graduate degree, and became a Spanish teacher at a university. And my mom was a high school Spanish teacher. And my grandpa, who had been the patriarch of the family and had a successful business in Cuba, was working as a custodian at a local hospital. And, you know, how difficult that was for him to go from being the Ways and Means committee to being, you know, a worker in the household. And, you know, she said he did not have an education. And so, you know, his life experience was one that because he didn't have an education, he lost everything, you know, including his standing in the family. And, you know, so I think that impressed upon me the importance and the value of an education. And so, you know, I think that marked in many ways the direction that I took. Obviously, my parents both were educators, and so that also had, you know, a strong influence in that. So I became a teacher. I was bilingual in English as a second language teacher in the Chicago suburbs, and then I became what at the time was called a coach, somebody who worked with new teachers coming into the district. I was in a community that was undergoing very rapid demographic change. So when I started in that school district, there were 3 bilingual teachers, and within 3 years, there were 30 bilingual teachers.
And so how big of a school system was it?
It was about 6,000 kids. It was a K-8 school district in the suburbs of Chicago. Cicero is the name of the town. And so, you know, it's a community that now, you know, 30 years later is predominantly Latino and at the time was just beginning to go through that. And so, you know, that kind of opened the doors of going outside the classroom and thinking about how I could influence, you know, education for more than the kids that were just in front of me. And so I think that was the door that opened things to administration. And then I held a number of school level and district level positions. I did a stint with the Illinois Department of Education, so at the state level. So I also saw sort of the policy piece and became very interested in policy and sort of how that plays into affecting the lives and the way that schools are organized. And then about 14 years ago, I moved to the Chicago Public Schools at the time that Arnie Duncan was the chief executive officer.
And Arnie Duncan being famously, I think, both a friend and associate of President Obama when he was in Illinois and then became Secretary of Education, right?
Right. So, and that was a very inspirational time to be in Chicago. I think I learned a lot.
Did you work with him directly?
I did, yeah.
From what I read, and it's all very subtext and subtle, but it's a very political, rough and tumble place, and where
I think that's
like 5 out of the last 10 governors have went to prison, and Blagojevich, or I can never pronounce his name.
Blagojevich.
Right. There's a lot of vowels and syllables there. Yeah. He just was turned down on his appeal to reduce his sentence, and for some reason, and I don't want to be disparaging to any group, but there was always a sense of Chicago mob politics and history. But it's not necessarily corrupt, but maybe a little bit corrupt. It's just a fascinating area, whether it's in education or politics. And how does that, from your experience both in the suburbs and then in the Chicago area, how does the rough and tumble Chicago kind of approach to, I don't want to say political corruption, but it's a rough place. And if you're in education and your focus is just on the kids and education, health and welfare, it has to intersect at some area. It's got to be political. It's got to be tough.
Yeah, I'm sure it does. And I think, you know, one of the things that set my experience apart, and, you know, I'm not Pollyannish about it. I, you know, saw the politics at work around some of the school closure decisions that, you know, that were made. Is I think that during Arnie Duncan's regime, that at the end of the day, he was very much focused on doing the right thing for kids. And whether you agreed with the decisions or you saw, you know, the political hands that were at work in making some of those decisions, I never hesitated for one second to believe that he was actually, you know, doing what he was doing because he believed it was the best thing for kids. And so I think that that was, you know, my experience. Obviously, one of the things that I also learned that has implications, I think, for the work here in Portland is that long-term stability in key leadership roles really does make a difference. When Arnie was the CEO for 8 years, and before him, there was another CEO that reported to the mayor, Paul Vallis, who was there for 7 years. So for 15 years, there was leadership continuity in the district, and that was something that it felt like we were making a difference, and you know, that there was a sense that things were getting better. And you know, in the 7 years that he's been gone, there's been maybe 5 superintendents, and you know, the system is in utter disarray now.
Well, we have Javier Botana, who is the recently appointed last spring the superintendent of the Portland school system. Talk a little bit about the process. So last year, you were talking about continuity and root system. So your predecessor, Emmanuel Koch, I think he was here from 2012 to last year, and he left last year to be an administrator in the Kentucky system. How does that work in the business? So you're in Illinois. The Portland school system sends up the bat signal, we need a superintendent here. And so is there a superintendent's or US job board? And so somehow you became aware of this position.
Yeah.
You have some history and familiarity to me. I think skiing in Sunday River in your file here.
Right.
So you came and interviewed. And as I said earlier, there were over 40 candidates. And so the Portland school system is a large school system. There's a lot of diversity, a lot of cultural diversity. Yeah. It's a fairly big school system. So how did that happen, and what was the interview process like? And then we'll talk about, after you were selected, and I think late May, what your transition has been in terms of moving to Maine. And as we're on the cusp of a new school year, we'll talk about the Portland school system.
Sure. The bat signal was really my Google feed for Portland, Oregon.
That's so funny.
I spent a year and a half as a chief academic officer in Portland, Oregon, and have a Google news feed. And occasionally in the Google news feed, there's Portland, Maine news stories. And so I just happened to see that the superintendent of Portland, Maine had left. And so I said to my wife, because, you know, as you mentioned, we've had a history of coming to Maine. My son has been involved with a Maine-based Camp No Limits, which is for children with limb differences, since he was 6 years old. And so we've been coming for, you know, Camp No Limits activities here, which includes Camp Snow Limits in Sunday River. And so I said, hey, would we ever consider moving to Maine? And she said, absolutely. And, you know, my son said, absolutely. And so, you know, I just then waited for the position to post. And it was, you know, it took a while, you know, so it wasn't like I was just out there applying for everything. I actually saw that one, talked to my family, and we thought, yeah, if we're going to make a move, you know, I'd been in Michigan City for 6 years. I felt I had done everything that I really wanted to do there and needed to challenge myself professionally. And so when this came up, it just seemed like, you know, somehow that it was meant to be. And
Funny. We have Javier Botana, the new superintendent of the Portland school system. A couple points are funny. One, how life in itself is funny. You know, the idea of a Google alert for Portland, Oregon coming into your box and being such a life-changing random occurrence, both for you and now for the school system. And then two, most of your exposure to Maine was in the winter months, where, as you mentioned, going up to Sunday River, if you're going there for skiing, it's a beautiful area.
Right.
But generally, you know, people look at late spring and the summer and the early fall as kind of the pretty months in Maine.
Yeah.
You know, I know that when I invite—
We also come for the summer camp.
Oh, okay. So you've been exposed.
We've seen both sides of it.
I was going to say, if you only saw the gray part, then that is amazing.
Yeah.
Because I have trouble getting people to visit in January, February. They're like, oh, we'll see you in May or June.
Yeah. Yeah.
So the process, and obviously for a large school system with a significant budget and a student population, the Portland School Board, so they have autonomy in the oversight of the school system. They call in a group of candidates. They whittle down all the applications. You presumably came here for an interview, and then generally there's a field trip that goes out from to the applicant's location to talk to colleagues or students. How long was that process? And at that point, talk a little bit about the process, getting the call.
So I think the position posted with they went through the due diligence process and getting input on what the community wanted from a superintendent. And they posted the position in February. I applied. I think my first on-site interview was they had a group of maybe six or seven candidates at that point that they interviewed, and I think that was in early April. And then I came back for a full-day interview that involved, you know, an interview with the school board, but also visits to schools and meetings with different groups of stakeholders. So they had a forum in the evening for parents and community folks, as well as meetings with business leaders and councilmen and things along those lines. So we did that, and then two of the board members visited my district and spent a day and a half sort of going around talking to different people that had worked with me. And then shortly after that is when I got the call. And obviously I was, you know, thrilled at that point. You know, you've gone.
That part would be the scariest part for me. Because anyone who's watched reality TV realizes that, you know, friends and foes and colleagues may say one thing. You know, and obviously you passed the process, and I don't mean to make light of it, but, you know, if I was applying for a job somewhere and they say, well, we're sending two people, and they're just going to go around Yarmouth, or they're just going to visit Tidesmart and just talk to people, I'd be like, oh, that's fantastic. But I'd be like, what is Emily going to say? I would be like,
you'll never know.
I know I'll never know. That's why I shouldn't be a candidate to run a school system, because there's always that human factor of like, oh, yeah, of course, Javier's great. And I was like, well, you know, geez, I don't know about Javier. If he's, you know, he always leaves early at about 1 o'clock in the afternoon. So that process worked. And then it was reported in the paper, and I think May 24th, there was a vote. The school board presumably made an offer, and you went through that process. When did you officially start and report to work? And then we'll talk about the steps of the school system here in the Portland school system.
So my first day was July 5th. You know, obviously, I think it was late May when the board actually approved my contract. And so there was about a month in between, and there were lots of things that I needed to do to come up to speed. And so, you know, while I was still working in my old district, I was, you know, taking time to communicate with folks here and try to get my bearings and deal with some of the issues as they were cropping up at that point. Working with the interim superintendent, Jeannie Crocker, and, you know, trying to weigh in on key decisions. We were hiring a principal for Portland High School. We had some senior leadership that had left the district, and we needed to make decisions about that. So I spent, you know, some time during those weeks also beginning to get engaged around some of the work. But my first official day was on July 5th.
So as we talk about the Portland public school system, we have Javier Botana, the new superintendent. For listeners that are certainly aware of what schools are, give a quick snapshot of what is the Portland public school system in terms of approximately the number of students, the number of faculty, what approximately the school budget, and how much of your role has to do with the business administration of ultimately running a fairly big enterprise, right, reporting to the school board, which I would characterize as kind of the board of trustees, and they oversee all the fiduciary and all the financial elements. But the role of superintendent, how much of it is running the business of hiring people and facilities and logistics, also looking at curriculum and the academic side? How would you describe the percentage, and then give a quick overview of the Portland public school system?
The job is, obviously, you're the lead educator in the system. The reason that, you know, they hire a superintendent who has an educational background is because the teaching and learning is the central aspect of the organization. So I obviously have to have broad understanding of all of the operational aspects of the district, but we have key staff in positions like a chief financial officer and a chief operations officer to make sure that we have on-the-ground expertise to be able to manage those aspects. I obviously did not go to school to, you know, understand facilities and, you know, how to maintain them, but I do understand the critical importance of facilities as a place for children to learn, and the importance of, you know, how they're set up and how they work and how they're maintained as being critical to the environment in which kids are learning. Portland's a fairly large school district. It's 7,000 pre-K through 12 students, and then about 3,000 adult students, because the district is also the adult education provider for the Portland area. You know, there's about 500 and change teachers in the school system, and it's one of the largest employers in the Portland metropolitan area. So, you know, there's a huge amount of time on the job that's spent dealing with the human capital in the district. That's, you know, our teachers are the central players in our organization. The work that they do is what makes a difference to, you know, every one of those 7,000 kids and all the 3,000 adults that are there. So it's focusing in on their needs and making sure that everything from their benefits to their the materials that they have and the climate in which they work, the leaders that they report to, that all of that is supporting their work is what I view as my central role. I report to the board. The board is made up of 9 really hardworking volunteers that are giving their time, and they give a lot of it, to make sure that the right decisions are made. And, you know, one of those important decisions is selecting somebody to be the superintendent, who's the only person in the district that actually reports to the school board. Everybody else, you know, reports to different, you know, whether it's a principal or whether it's the superintendent, they report to somebody else within the organization. So it's obviously, and that's why they spent the amount of time that they did and did the due diligence that they did in finding somebody that they felt was the right fit for the school district.
We talked a little bit earlier, and we have Javier Botana, the new superintendent of schools for Portland, about coming from Chicago or Illinois school system where a deep root system of continuity and leadership was a positive thing, and recently there's been a lot of transitions. Here in Portland, there has been, I don't want to say there's been a tremendous amount of turnover, but there hasn't been a lot of longevity, I think, in the Portland school system. And what is the school board expecting from you relative to, you know, the mission of hiring you? What does success look like? How much of it is quantifiable relative to graduation rates or testing scores, which some school systems, I think, weigh more heavily? We have a significant multicultural universe, both in terms of students and families and the adults who you're also involved with education. So what's the mission when they hired you and they said, okay, Javier, here is what success looks like. We really want to focus on these one or two things. And how has that kind of played out since you've started and what you're going into the school year focusing on?
Yeah. So through the interview process, the district has been working under a strategic plan that has been around since 2011. Obviously, there's been different leaders in the organization during that period of time. So a big part of the desire of the board, I think, was to find somebody that they felt had a commitment to staying here. And so I think, you know, for some of the reasons that I've talked about and, you know, some that I haven't. So the fact I'm 53 years old, I'm not, you know, somebody who is, you know, early in his career looking to, you know, to position himself for a larger school system. I've worked in large school systems. I know what I want career-wise, and the diversity in Portland is something that's extremely attractive. My story is not all that different from the story of, you know, 35% of our kids, or probably more, because there's lots of kids who don't qualify as language minority who do come from backgrounds where education was the vehicle that made them, you know, succeed and realize the American dream. So I think they were looking for somebody that would present a long-term stability for the district. I think that was an important part of that. That strategic plan that they've been working on is, you know, set to expire this year, and it did. And so a big part of my early work is around, you know, coming up with the next iteration of the district's comprehensive plan. And so we're in that process right now, and that will articulate what I will be accountable for to the board and in a very public way to Portland as a community. And so, you know, you can expect that among those goals will be the continuation of a focus on improving our graduation rate and graduating kids who are ready for the next step in life. So whether that is going to college and succeeding in college, or, you know, going off to a career, having, you know, a good understanding of what that next step is for them, I think that those will definitely be our goals. We also will show that we're committed to reducing the gaps in those graduation rates and in the performance leading up to those graduation rates among our students who have the least means. And so that will be something that we will hold ourselves accountable for, because that is something that, you know, we're only as strong as a community as our weakest link. And so the extent to which we can do something about those achievement gaps will mark how successful I am and how successful we are as a community.
No, no restriction on your access to Google for Portland, Oregon? They didn't shut that down? I'm joking, of course. For those listeners that may have missed it earlier, we talked with Javier Botana, the new superintendent of schools, where it was a Google alert that was misdirected from Portland, Oregon for Portland, Maine, that actually made him aware of the position here.
Yeah.
Fascinating story. I am on the board, soon to come off the board, of the Boys and Girls Clubs of Southern Maine. So our facilities and mandates intersect a little bit with the Portland school system, particularly in Portland, where for the boys and girls that attend the clubs, it becomes an extension, kind of an adjunct to core education. And so, you know, my experience has been very positive relative to the Portland public school systems. So have you and your family, have you moved to Portland, and have you completed that whole real estate? Because moving's the worst.
Yeah, it is.
It's just packing stuff and throwing away stuff.
Right there is a good reason not to ever do this again, you know, just to
stay. I moved 15 times in my first 20 years of my career, and I've only moved once in the last 20 years. And that is like a quiet joy that exists, because moving is just the worst.
Yeah. We're not fully here. My family will be coming first week in September. I'm going back in a week to drive my wife, the two dogs, you know, across country and stuff. So we're looking forward to being together. And, you know, we're still selling our home in Indiana. So we are just renting a place through May, and then hopefully by then we'll be in a position to know exactly where we're going to be. But we're looking forward to being back together as a family.
Talk about there's an intersection in academics and politics and local economics having to do with immigration, multicultural populations, and it feels like it has become louder and more pronounced in the last few years, driven from kind of political agendas. I am, my grandparents immigrated from Ireland, and the United States at its very fabric is a country built upon immigration and about a melting pot. And you telling your story coming from Cuba when you were just 2 years old, I think is an inspiring story. Many young people in Southern Maine, in the Portland School District, and also other areas, you know, talking about Lewiston, Auburn, where there's a high population, immigrant population, Somalian population, other countries. It's been politicized so much in terms of the current presidential campaign, talking about closing our borders, talking about not vilifying, but creating this fear and this distrust about immigration. And when you're working in education, as you're going into a new school year, and you mentioned that there's about 7,000 students and about 3,000 adults, my guess is many of the adults are involved with language programs in terms of English being a second language. You're dealing with many immigration issues, not just technically academics of math and English, but cultural issues, respecting religious issues. Right. And from your background and experience as an educator and as an administrator, coming into a school system and coming into a societal period in 2016 where it is somewhat controversial. It intersects socioeconomic issues of what's going on in Portland and support programs and after-school programs. And talk about the immigration aspect, the multicultural aspect of overseeing a school system, and either what your plans are from your background in terms of how to approach it maybe in a different way, and what you think the future is relative to multicultural immigration, being accepting and serving all 10,000 boys and girls and adults who qualify for the school system in the best way possible.
Right. That's a great question. It's obviously been a difficult period because of the hyper noise around this issue during the election. And, you know, I think one of the things that attracted me to Portland is the fact that it is an incredibly diverse city, but it also strikes me as a city where, and, you know, not universally, not every person, but as a community, there is a concerted effort to try to do the right thing for every citizen in Portland, and that includes those recent arrivals. You know, from an education perspective, that's the population I've worked with my entire career. I started working with recent immigrant children who were learning English. That's where I went to school to specifically work in that arena. And I say this to people all the time. As a educator, this is a dream population to work with, because that same experience that I shared about my grandmother helping me to understand the importance of education is the same story that is playing out in every single one of those households, where parents love what we have to offer. The reason they're here, the reason that some of them have risked their life to be here, is because they want something better for their children, and they universally understand that education is the vehicle to that. So from, you know, my standpoint, you know, I feel like this is a great place to be, because, you know, we have a population that is our most at risk, that are absolutely wanting to consume what it is that we're selling. And so that's a tremendous potential right there. And we have a community overall that understands that, demography being what it is in Maine, that this community is going to be a substantial part of our economic development as a state for years to come. And so, you know, I think that those are great, that I feel like we're in the middle of the right, even with all of the negative rhetoric out there, that we are in a fairly unique position to really show the rest of the country that this is a tremendous opportunity. The diversity that we have is, you know, one of the ways in which this country became great and can continue to become great.
And to me, it's an interesting dichotomy. We have Javier Botana, the new superintendent of schools, Portland Public School System, because on the state level, we're a massive state in terms of size. The other four New England states can fit inside of Maine. And on one level, people look at Maine as being anything but diverse. Because on the macro level of 1.3 million people on a percentage-wise, we're either the least or in the bottom two or three relative to racial diversity. But then you look at Portland, and you look at Lewiston, Auburn, you look at, to a smaller extent, maybe Bangor, the three metro areas, and there are large pockets of diversity. And I saw a chart the other day where 15 of the largest billion-dollar companies that have emerged in the last 5 or 10 years directly were led or founded by immigrants in the last 20 years. And so whether it's in computer science or other areas, it's our future relative to the new economy. Right. But there is such resistance. And when you add racial issues and then religious issues, and sometimes associated with ignorance of other faiths, that has to be kind of part of your challenge and part of your mission in terms of how to incorporate a population of 10,000 students, whether they're adults or pre-K through 12, while respecting religions and race. And I read somewhere that there's almost 60 different languages represented by your student population. So even the communication thing has to be a challenge in the school system,
sure.
Right?
It is. And just to give you an example, this past board meeting, last week, board has been working with a group called Portland Empowered that has been working to create a better way of engaging parents, and particularly parents who are language minority of color, into our systems. And so, you know, little things go a long way when you talk about sort of understanding the diversity. So, you know, Portland High School has traditionally had a barbecue for its ninth grade incoming freshmen. And this year, as a result of their work with Portland Empowered, they've recast that as a gathering and just recognizing that barbecue had connotations that there was going to be pork on the grill. And so that was a way that in some ways was understood to not be welcoming of the diversity in the community. So they've recast it. They've worked with the Portland Empowered Group to reach out to their language minority communities, and they're looking forward to having great turnout for their freshman orientation as a result of doing those things. We have a multicultural office. We translate all of our materials into 8 languages. We have a team of people that really hard to help us figure out how do we engage with those various communities. And, you know, as you said, there's 60 different language groups. There's, you know, they change. It's not always the same groups. And so we're always challenged to be able to keep up with that. But we think that in the balance, that's part of why people live in Portland, and we believe that's one of the reasons that Portland has the potential that it has. And so, you know, there's an economic aspect to it, there's a cultural aspect to it, and, you know, I clearly think that we're better because of it, and I think that most of the people that live there do as well.
I agree. We have Javier Botana. In the last couple of minutes we have, I don't want to characterize this as the speed round, but I have 4 or 5 other subjects. Love to get your quick thoughts. And the problem with these subjects is they could be 1-hour discussions. So I will stipulate at the front end that we'll start with an easy one: charter schools. Here in Maine, there's a history of charter schools. Portland has a number. What has been both your experience relative to charter schools, and what is your forward view here in Maine, and particularly within the Portland district, of what role they may play?
Yeah. I think that charter schools are not a panacea. So anybody who thinks that the solution to the challenges facing education today are in charter schools, that's not factual. I do think that parental choice and giving families options is important. And so I look at, you know, charter schools as valid and as a potential way for families to have their choices met. And I think as a public school educator that, you know, my job is to make sure that, you know, that our product, what we offer, is every bit as appealing as what a charter or a non-public school, private school would have. And that's my goal. So I'm not against them. I'm not for them. I think that they exist and that they have value and that, you know, parents want them. And I want to figure out what it is that they offer that parents want and figure out if we can't do that ourselves.
Great. Next question. Much of both kind of the mass media and the thinking about secondary education is that, and I have my own kind of personal history with this, is we drive students into a pervasive point of view, which is everyone should go to college, where to be successful as a student, to be successful in life. I spent 9 years as an adjunct professor at 4 universities. And so my academic experience was from a teaching perspective more than as a student. I agree with everything you said, that education is the foundation that sets you up in other areas. But my point of view is, for many students, that next level of education could and should be college, because there's a different level of learning. There's social development. There's the experience of being on campus and maturity and all. But for many students, whether it's vocational or it's other jobs, that's just as viable.
Sure.
But it feels like much of the communication, not from you personally, but from various channels, is that, well, you go through 12th grade and you need to go to 13th grade or 14th grade, being symbolic for college. But for some students, whether it's doing something else, many students elect military service. Maine has one of the highest rates of military enrollment and highest populations of veterans. So we have a great base of people who've sacrificed for our military and for our country. But for many people, whether it's being a plumber or a painter or any job they want to do, I've always looked at those things as being noble and valuable and honorable professions. But sometimes I don't think that message comes across to young people. And there's also some stigma. It's like when a kid's graduating, oh, where are you going to college? Well, I'm not. I'm going to be an electrician. Right. Oh, isn't that nice? You know what? We need It's a great job, and it is technology is getting better. It's a more technical job. What's your thinking as the superintendent of the Portland school system? How to both accommodate students on a path to college and also accommodating students that may not want to go to college and still want to have a viable, happy, successful, next phase of their career?
Yeah. I mean, I think, when I talk about what our job is graduating kids from high school that are ready for additional learning, whether that additional learning is college or whether it's getting a certification of some kind that opens up the doors to a profession, I think they're both just as valuable. We have a career and technical school, the PATHS school, which is a regional technical school. And, we really need to do a good job of marketing what kids get coming out of that. I spent some time yesterday with one of our student board members who is the representative for PATHS, and he is a brilliant kid. He can go to college, and he's thinking about what he's going to do, but he knows that through the work that he's done at PATHS, that he can get a job as a machinist when he leaves high school, making $35,000, $40,000 a year, which is, a really solid salary that he can then decide, does he want to pay and go to college while he does that? Does he want to save that? Or does he want to make that his career path? And so what we want to do is we want to prepare more students so that they have those options available to them. He may decide that he wants to go to college, and he may decide that he wants to do that with the money that he's made as a machinist, which will save him from getting into student loans that he'll be paying off for the next 20, 25 years. Right. So it's really important to create those opportunities. So when you hear us talk about preparing kids, we will say things like for college and career. And somehow we've got to make sure that that's understood, that the career is not second and a fallback, but rather, an absolutely viable option. Some of those jobs that you talked about pay much better than the jobs that most students who go to college can get when they leave and take on their first job, in many cases with lots of loans and things along those lines.
Yeah, and I don't want to call out anyone particularly, but when I interview a number of people, and it feels like every week I'll interview somebody with an undergrad or graduate degree, and it's in French lit or museum display something, and they haven't really been employed for 5 years, and they're overeducated because they're not grounded in what they're interested in themselves, or they pick something so kind of niche or esoteric. But if it's not a viable vocation, and if it can't sustain you relative to, the economics of the job, and so I try to convey the same. I speak at school sometimes and just saying, hey, pick your passion, and if it's a field where you need more immersive education and academic support, find that path, and colleges are a great resource for that.
Right. I agree 100%. I think if you look at the economy today, the likelihood that you're going to graduate either from high school or from college and go on and work for the same employer for the next 35 years and retire with a pension is extremely low.
Unless you work here at TideSmart, we want people to stay here for years. So none of that talk about switching jobs here. I'm kidding.
The reality is that you, even if you're at TideSmart, TideSmart is going to expect you to get smarter.
I'd love to have you come back. We're running out of time, but I wish you and the school system the best of luck. I think the Portland City school system and all education is really the engine for our state. Yeah. And we have Javier Bortana, who is the brand new, started on July 5th. School year starts in the next couple of weeks. Wish you and the entire school system best of luck, and we'd love to have you come back sometime soon.
I look forward to it. This has been great, and we want our kids back in school, ready to go. Just it's the beginning of school, and learning never ends.
You've been listening to TideSmart Talk with Steve-O, News Talk WLOB, 1310 a.m. and 100.5. We'll be back next week.